Welcome to the BISCOS Pediatric Orthopaedic Digest or podcast. It's a panel discussion of what we regard as the most interesting published papers of relevance to pediatric orthopaedic surgeons. Please do remember the views are our own and not those of the BISCOS board, committees or membership. Hello, welcome to the BISCOS Pediatric Orthopaedic Digest cast. I'm Anish Singrajka, and if only this was like Have I Got News For You with another version where you could have all the bits that have gone wrong, because we've only just started recording it and we have made many problems already. But the rest is going to be awesome. I can feel it. So as always, we've got Alpesh Kothari with us.
Hi there.
And producer Pranay.
Hey guys.
Today, we've got special guest star Claire Murnaghan from Glasgow. Whoop, whoop.
Hello.
Well, hi, Claire. Nice to meet you. So this is my bit. I get to know our guests. We've not met before.
No.
But it's a pleasure to meet you. How's your week been?
It's been great. I'm actually first day of holidays, just traveled down to somewhere called England. And staying in a nice little cottage here, so really looking forward to the week ahead of outdoors, walking, having a nice time.
Good stuff. So our old fellow, I think, is with you at the moment, Shady.
Yes. And
he was telling me lots of good things about your unit, but why don't you tell me a bit about your unit and what you guys get up to up north?
Okay, so we are working at the Royal Hospital for Children, formerly known as York Hill. The hospital was resited and opened in a brand new all singing, all dancing building in 2015. There are 8 consultants in the unit, so it's a big, big unit. It's really busy for trauma. And all of us are fairly generalist, but then with subspecialties. So we cover all the 0 to 16-year-old trauma in the west of Scotland. We're also a tertiary referral centre for elective things, and we are also a major trauma centre. We've got a brilliant team, really nice people, great team, and now that I'm mentioning it, we've recently advertised for a new consultant colleague to replace a retiring colleague.
Oh, there
so
we
just
go.
In case anyone's interested, there's a wee plug.
A good plug.
Yeah.
So you know, some of you will know that the theme is Halloween, which I thought was quite appropriate when I read your bio, because you mentioned the brachial plexus service, and brachial plexus tends to send shivers down a lot of people's spines and is a bit of a dark art. And I was wondering if you tell me about your involvement and over the last 13 years and how the service has developed and your role in that, please.
Yeah, and I'm talking about it in the past tense, because actually just last month I've left the service for various reasons, but not because it's not working. It's a great service. So we provide a national service for all of Scotland and Northern Ireland. There were 3 of us involved, myself, Tim Hems and Andy Hart. Tim Hems is an adult orthopaedic surgeon. Andy is one of the plastic surgeons. And we see about 45 to 50 new cases a year, but thankfully, very few of those require surgical intervention. The vast majority resolve spontaneously, which is what we want. Since I joined the service, I think it's come on leaps and bounds in that we have a physiotherapist and an occupational therapist and a psychologist all in clinic with us. And we run a clinic once every 3 weeks. So there's 2 or 3 of the consultants there each time, plus the therapists. And actually the way it has evolved, which I think is correct, is that the therapists are so much more important than the medical staff. So they're branching out and doing their own therapy clinics, and the patients love it. You know, to have somebody that they know and can relax with and we've got psychology involvement, you know, watching through the eyes of the physio and OT. It's excellent. And as I say, we've got the contract for Northern Ireland as well. So that's tricky for the Northern Irish patients to make the journey over to Glasgow, much as it's only a very short journey. And I have to say that with COVID and the use of remote attend anywhere consultations, that has really helped things to a point. It's very, very difficult to examine a newborn, particularly a newborn's brachial plexus remotely. But yeah, it's great service, really good.
Brilliant. Well, I did, you know, the standard web stalking before this. So I Googled it. And lots of lovely pictures come up of you guys receiving lots of awards for your work. And I mean, I think there's something about Scotland and its networks and which is really quite impressive, you know, when you think of the CPIPs and other networks. So yep. It's great. And whilst you may have left the service, I'm sure your legacy will live on for a long time. And thanks Hopefully. For your involvement in that.
And it's a relatively small country when you think of it. So most of us know each other, and it's very easy to lift the phone and chat to somebody for advice or vice versa.
And yeah, also there's a funny line in your bio where you said you did your fellowships at Great Ormond Street and Stanmore, and you met some odd people down there. Did you meet Anish then? Did you?
How did you guess? Yes, there it was Anish.
That's possibly one of the nicer things she said about me, I think.
So then you scarpered back up north as quick as you could. Is that
right? Yeah, absolutely. If they were all like that. Oh, although brilliant. Anish said that up north was Watford.
And it was you explaining that the Watford gap wasn't actually at Watford and was even further north. That was news to me as well.
Good stuff. Well, as I said before, lovely to meet you. So Claire, why don't you tell us about your paper then?
Yeah, I will. I think I've chosen a paper which is maybe a little odd to have chosen this, but it's cast revision is effective.
Nothing less, Claire.
Good. Cast revision is effective for critical 3-point index values in paediatric forearm fractures, and it's a prospective study. It was in JPO in September of this year. I should really tell you my reason for this. For our trainees who come through the Children's Hospital in Glasgow, I think they are sick of the sound of our voices telling them that everything they learned about casts before they came to us is probably going to be wiped from their brains and we're going to do it all over again. And you know what it's like. We get the ST6s and 7s coming to us who are really experienced. They know lots. And then there's a consultant in theatre with them telling them how to put on a plaster. And I think it's, you know, at times they maybe find it a little bit patronising. The importance of getting a cast right in children is the reason that I chose this paper, rather than the very complex mathematics involved in it. We regularly, in all of our trauma meetings and discussions, we use the cast index, which most of us are familiar with. And this paper talks about the cast index. But it also says that this 3-point index, which is a figure that has been thought up or developed, should I say, by other members of this unit in Turkey.
Yeah.
They felt that it was a better way of monitoring not just the original plaster, but what happens during management of this fracture. And I really like the idea of that. And there are a few things that I'm not saying that I would follow this exactly, but I like the idea that they sequentially look at this TPI, the 3-point index. Now, I've just alluded to the fact that it is very complex, and I'm not going to tell you in lots of words how to work it out. But we all know what the cast index is. We all know that it's the internal plaster width on the lateral view divided by the internal plaster width on the AP view. But this is different. This is looking at your 3-point molding, and it is measuring a gap distal to the fracture on the radial side, then on the ulnar side, right at the fracture line. And then your 3rd point is proximal, about 3 to 7 centimetres, more proximal than the fracture line on the radial side on the AP.
So I think representing it, that 3-point pressure, right? So you've got one.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So it is measuring. So it's the smallest gap. So in other words, that is where you are applying the pressure on that plaster. Yeah. And then it also includes the contact area of each fracture. So these were all both bone fractures. Hmm. Now, the interesting thing is that the TPI was originally developed for more distal fractures. So they have tweaked this a little bit, and there's no real explanation of how they chose these, I'm sure not as random as it looks, figures of 3 to 7 centimetres proximal. To me, rather than setting absolute measurements from the fracture site, I think looking at the fracture and where the moulding is where you would take these measurements. So the whole premise of this paper is that you put a plaster on, and oh, sorry, I should have said, every single one of these is done in the outpatients, which was my other real interest. Mm. We're trying our best to get some sedation lists set up in our hospital. And every single one of these was under, can I just say, this is my favourite word of the paper, sedoanalgesia. I thought that was fantastic. So no general anaesthetics. So the plaster is put on with the child comfortable. And then a senior person looks at it, calculates the TPI and decides whether it is greater than 0.8 or less than 0.6. And anyone that lies in between 0.6 and 0.8, they feel there is a risk of it redisplacing. Therefore, that child is brought back again. And the interesting thing is, I don't know what other centres do. Generally, if we've had one go at manipulating a child's forearm fracture with sedoanalgesia, next time round, you're not really going to get very close to them. And we tend to then opt to bring them into theatre for a general anaesthetic. But I was interested here that sometimes there were 3-4 attempts at remanipulation without a general anaesthetic. So I thought that was fairly brave of them. And the other thing was that they did repeat radiographs quite frequently. I've actually written down here lots of radiation because they're performing x-rays at the 1st, 2nd, 4th, and 6th weeks. And I think sometimes if you know by week 2 or 3 that it's looking all right, then we maybe would not x-ray so frequently. Yeah. The other thing I thought was that there were lots of variables. I'm just going to read out this one paragraph, which is: evaluation was made of the relationship between redisplacement and TPI after the first casting. Late TPI, casting type, that's whether there was a box or a banana type cast at the elbow, sex, displacement, angulation of the first fracture, distance between the radius and ulna, age, you know, there are lots and lots of variables. However, they recognised the fact that it's difficult to reproduce these x-rays. That was the other thing that came to my mind, that for a child of 4 to 12 in this age group, it is very difficult to get the same AP radiograph and the same lateral radiograph every time they come to clinic, particularly in long arm plasters. You know what it's like trying to get a wiggly child to get a good radiograph. And these aren't children who are asleep where we're getting decent x-rays in theatre. So I think I'm basically coming around to say that I'm not going to use TPI. I find
what? You've wasted our time.
So I find it a really complicated calculation, which is difficult to standardize because of the reasons I've said. However, I really like the idea that people are measuring plasters, looking at plasters and understanding that they are imperative for management of children. And I can't abide folk who just stick a plaster on that looks like a tube and then wonder why the fracture displaces. So I still quite like my cast index and I will continue to use cast index, but I will also, and I think any of my trainees who've worked with me know that I might not make a measurement, but I will always comment on molding. Where is the molding? Is it appropriate? Is it 3-point fixation in that plaster?
I think it just highlights basically that the better the cast, the less likely things are to redisplace, which is good. But I think you touched upon a good point about being able to use this pseudo analgesia. So then you have the luxury of remolding if you want to, without having to have a general anaesthetic.
Yep.
But I think, I guess, a point worth discussing is whether the criteria that they've used for redisplacement, they're like, actually, is it going to make any clinical difference if you just run with it, basically?
Yeah.
But I guess that's a separate issue. That's
particularly with what we're now learning about angulation and forearm fractures. But these were very specific. They're not distal.
No.
They are mid or proximal, and they are both bones and their shaft. And therefore, I think it is more... I think they're correct in their the values that they're using for remanipulation. But yes, I think my final point is that it's surely more important to ensure that there's excellent casting rather than to make an assessment of those casts more and more complex, because I worry that will put people off. You know, once you start doing all the measurements and, you know, what's your TPI, by the time you've calculated it, and when you think of it, you're doing it on day zero, then week one, you know, each time. I think that's fairly onerous, but the idea is good. And that is why we manipulate a fracture and then see them back at fracture clinic in a week and at 2 weeks, because we're assessing all of those things, the cast index, the molding, etc.
I think you're right.
And so that's what I think.
In terms of what you say about plastering, so I think it is something that we see. And I guess when you think about it, how many adults with a fracture of their forearm go to theatre just for a plaster to be applied?
So I know.
I think that's why actually it is, you know, I hate saying it's a lost art and people need Chandler's book. And what was amazing during COVID was people were sending PDFs of Chandler's book, weren't they? I think things have got a bit better since then or moved on. How dare I say something like that about that Bible? But, you know, I started off by reading that paper thinking, man, this is way too complex. As you say, you've got to measure the bones. You've got to add them up. You've got to divide it by something and then look to see where Sagittarius lies in the celestial heavens and then work out whether that's acceptable. But actually, I think one, you're right. Rather than just cast index, which is just, is it oval? This is talking about that 3.6.
Yeah.
And what I really liked was if their stuff genuinely works the way they say it does, you can look at that plaster on week one, and even though the fracture may not have displaced, it is high. It's predictive of displacement.
Yeah,
that's what I really liked, because initially I was just thinking, well, if the bone's displaced, we can see that. But what they were saying is, no, you could predict it. So actually, and the fact that actually at that stage, because I'm always a bit nervous about taking the plaster off at week one. You know, we're normally reinforcing the back slab.
Yeah.
And then it got me thinking, well, maybe, you know, I'd love to now see what happens if you reinforce a back slab, and can you make that 3-point mold better? Probably not.
No, Anish. Do you think, hold on, sorry. Do you think you can do 3-point molding on a back slab? Really?
No, Claire, definitely not. No.
Did I give a clue as to the answer there?
Yeah. Man, luckily the people listening can't see the video. We'd have to rate this 18. No, I do see what you're saying, but I suppose what I was thinking is, well, it would improve the cast index, wouldn't it, if you're wrapping this thing really, really tight. And I was thinking, well, depending on where your back slab is, could you then be putting plaster on and putting a bit of 3-point fix on there in addition? What do you think?
I think an absolute no. I'm really sorry to disagree with you.
No, that's all right. Most people do.
No, I don't believe we should be treating any of these fractures in a back slab. And if they need molding, they need a full plaster. And that's what our kids get in our emergency department. If we're lucky enough, we'll get some ketamine in resus in order to do it. Otherwise, it's fentanyl.
For the kids as well, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they join the back of the queue. But they, I'm so hoping for some editing on this.
Benito Prano is shaking his head.
I know. But if they are not adequately analgesed, then you just don't proceed. Yeah, pseudo analyses. Then they're just, you just don't proceed because you're not going to get it done properly. Yeah. So if there is a displaced forearm fracture, they will either have a full cast with molding applied in ED, or they'll be booked for the next day's trauma list. So we wouldn't use a back sub. In fact, from all the surrounding hospitals, they are sent to us for application of plasters in ED.
Oh, right. So the other guys won't do that?
No.
Okay.
Not very much.
Well, I say that actually. So there's a similar situation. We've got a kind of peripheral smaller hospital that's part of our trust, and they do a little bit of that, but not a lot. So sometimes they do come to our ED for that as well.
Okay.
But yes, we are, our registrars and trainees won't put on full plasters. They'll put on very molded back slabs. So you might have, you know, kind of back slab with a gutter, and they seem to do all right. But yeah, Claire's kind of doing her best impression of the Edward Munch scream. I think it's because it's Halloween.
We've got another. Well, that's another study, haven't we? We can pick Amish and Claire's casting techniques.
Let's have a cast off.
Yeah, cast.
But no, I think so. Actually, that paper got me thinking. You're right. I don't think it's
me
one
too.
That. It sounds, I think it sounds, well, it sounded complicated, and it still sounds like it's going to be harder to measure than they even make it sound. So, but I'm definitely going to give that a try to see. And I think what's really good about it is it's another thing to torture registrars with, because they'll all have read about the CAST index, maybe the Canterbury index. They're not going to have heard about this. So if they're doing really well, you can then raise an eyebrow and say, yeah, but what about the 3-point? Ha ha.
Yeah.
And it's flummoxed. Thank you. Any more comments on that one before we go?
Well, I think this, the x-ray they had was quite interesting, because it had the ulna with its apex one way and the radius with the apex the other way. And so where should you put your where should you mold? But anyway,
I think that was maybe a little rotationally suspect.
And that's probably their best x-ray.
Yeah, you always pick the cream of the crop.
Yeah.
They may be listening, Anish, so I think they actually was lovely.
Yeah, that's true. It was awesome. Really good paper.
Thanks, Claire.
No problem.
Right, and then so shall we move on to, so we've got the bite sizes. So Alpesh, do you want to tell us what, so I don't know what you thought, Alpesh, but in the last 3 months, actually, there have been some really good papers. I had trouble whittling it down to just a few that I wanted to talk about. What did you think?
I agree 100%. And I think what's also interesting that you see a lot more of the papers are coming from bigger research groups. And, you know, they're really good at coming up with acronyms, I think, which is key to success.
That's what you have to get first, isn't it? Even before the study idea.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I thought there were some good papers. So I've got five to discuss, actually, and two are just of general interest and three are orthopedic papers. I'm going to go with my general interest first. So we've got JAMA from September, Wagner et al. Out of Emory Children's Center in Atlanta. So their paper title is Concordance of SARS-CoV-2 Results in Self-Collected Nasal Swab versus Swabs Collected by Health Workers in Children and Adolescents. Now, I thought this paper was particularly relevant due to the recent resurgence of COVID, and also the fact that I hate swabbing my kids. Like, I'm running around after them, they're screaming, they're tears, and that's just me. So, so basically, this was a really simple study where they got healthcare professionals to swab around nearly 200 kids, and they got the kids themselves to watch some educational material and to do the swab themselves. And they found that this was kids 4 to 14. They found basically nearly 100% concordance between whether the healthcare professional did it or whether the child did it, whether it was positive or negative. Amazingly, actually, there was one sample where there was no result because it wasn't sufficient, and that was taken by the healthcare worker. So that's good. I can get my kids to do their own swabs now. So I was quite pleased about that.
I thought it was astonishing. Absolutely astonishing. If you'd asked me what percentage I thought of, particularly of the sort of 4 to 8 year olds, I thought it was they were incredible. They're probably better than some of the adults who have to do it.
Yeah, No, exactly. So that was, I enjoyed that paper. And now I find trawling through the journals, it takes quite a lot of time. You're sitting at the desk, which is not ideal. It's not very good for your health. And whilst I was doing this, I came upon a paper which discussed this topic. And that was from BMJ from August, Edwardson et al. Out of Leicester. So their paper was Effectiveness of an Intervention for Reduced Sitting Time and Improving Health in Office Workers, a three-arm cluster randomized trial. So basically, in this RCT, they looked at primarily at sitting time using accelerometers in office workers under three conditions. So there was one control, which was just standard, and then two intervention groups. So the intervention groups both had this thing called smart work and life intervention. So I'm going to read out this line because this is what is, they're multifaceted strategies to get workers to stand up at work more, focusing on organizational, environmental, individual and group approaches. That's amazing. But then actually two of those groups had this, and then one also had, of these two, had an height adjustable desk. And so they would be standing at a desk instead of sitting at a desk. Basically, the multifaceted intervention worked, but the height adjustable desk was found to be threefold more effective in reducing sitting time. And actually, these office workers sat over an hour less with these threefold, with the adjustable desk. Now, obviously, this doesn't directly apply to us because we don't spend a huge amount of time at the desk. But there are a host of admin staff, managers who spend all day sitting at a desk. And, you know, I think I've never seen a standing desk in a hospital in the UK. I've seen quite a lot of sick kids, quite a few of them used it there. It's meant to be good for your health, good for your quality of life, musculoskeletal pain, less sickness. Some of our admin staff take 2 to 3 days a month sickness routinely. Maybe they need a standing desk. Mm. Maybe we should stand for the rest of the Zoom. I don't know. What do you reckon?
Yeah. Okay, let's do it. I think the problem is this paper, you could see how it could be used in the wrong way. So it'll be, I'm going to get into work in the next few weeks and someone will have read this paper and got rid of all of our desks. Now you don't need desks in your office. You could all have a standing desk, which would basically be like a bar, wouldn't it? So if you know, when you go to Italy and you go to those espresso kind of bars, you're all standing there just typing away, nowhere to actually sit or do anything. But I see, I guess, and that's the thing we do get in our job, isn't it? We get to move around a bit. We aren't just at that desk for so long. And I imagine that would be very different. And what you're saying is it seems to be giving them the option of being able to stand or sit. That seems, which makes really, I mean, it makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. I was wondering. No, I was just wondering that if you walked into a clinic room and your clinician was standing, would you feel that they were hurrying you along and didn't have time? I don't know. This is obviously not medical. I just wonder if you walked in and somebody was standing there, is it almost like, oh, sorry, I won't sit down either. I'll just say my bit and go. And are we so used to sitting and being welcoming and asking them to relax? It's a mindset though, isn't it? That if everybody was standing, then everyone would stand.
We were talking about a clinician actually at work last week. So someone who worked somewhere else who did their clinics like that. So they'd be standing at the door. The patient would walk in. Clinician would shake their hand. And this would be post arthroplasty surgery. Say, wow, you're walking really well. And gently spin them around then. Walk them straight out the door again. So you can see how standing has its advantages.
Yeah.
I do sometimes have to use the stand in a kind of, we have run out of time now. What do you guys do? Do you normally sit comfortably and stick a chair on the side of your desk so that they all feel really happy and cozy?
We do. But I have to say again, in fracture clinic, when we're, you know, it's absolutely packed, it is really quite useful to be able to stand. And one of the fracture clinics I worked in years and years ago, the patients were put in little slots behind curtains and we walked in. And so it was you that was walking in and out of the cubicle, and it was incredibly efficient.
And I think that gives the patient time to sort themselves out as well, because actually that's always a bit awkward at the end, isn't it? Because the patient actually feels like they're getting in the way when they're trying to get their stuff back on.
Oh, I know. Whatever. Yeah.
And, you know, it is really about them, and actually being able to walk from one room to another just to keep things flowing is a nice way of doing things.
Especially to be able to leave the crushed bag of Quavers on the floor and walk out instead of saying, no, it's okay, I'll pick that up.
It's stuff. So, well, this standing paper has got a lot of people talking then. So that's some things we can think about in our workplace. So moving on to the orthopedic papers now. So the first was from Knee Surgery Sports Traumatology Arthroscopy Journal from October. Macchiarola et al. From Bologna. So paper titled High Recall Bias in Retrospective Assessment in the Pediatric International Knee Documentation Committee Questionnaire. The PEDI IKDC in children with knee pathologies. So I think we all acknowledge the importance of PROMs as an important outcome measure in research studies, but sometimes in some slightly dubious studies, they try and acquire them retrospectively. So this study sought to see what the differences were in questionnaire scores when they were obtained contemporaneously, and then when children 12 months after their surgery reported their pre-surgical health. So basically just reiterating, what were you like before your operation? And then they compared the two questionnaires. They had 66 youngsters in their study, and I guess it was obvious, but it's worth commenting that there was very poor concordance between the prospective IKDC and the recall IKDC, and they used various concordance statistics. But actually, when you look at the mean scores, so the prospective IKDC was 76.8 and the recall was 60.4. So that's a massive difference, actually, mm-hmm. when you're asking them what their health was at the same point in time. So opposite of rose-tinted specs here. So that was interesting. So I think, you know, we need to be careful if we're doing retrospective PROMs and probably not do them at all and collect them prospectively on all our patients.
Yeah.
So, okay, well, now we're going to go across the pond. So this is a paper, I think, that Anish found, came across as well. So it's a paper from the FACT study group out of Boston, Massachusetts, Hayworth et al. 2-year functional outcomes of operative versus non-operative treatment of completely displaced mid-shaft clavicle fractures in adolescents. So that was in the American Journal of Sports Medicine September issue. So this was a great study, really. A prospective observational cohort study comparing the outcomes for children who had displaced mid-shaft clavicle fractures. Those managed non-operatively versus those who had surgery. The decision to operate was left to the treating surgeon. They had 2-year data on 282 patients, 194 treated non-operatively, 88 treated operatively. They acknowledged some differences in groups and did some propensity matching as well. But the bottom line, cutting to the chase, at 2 years, using a variety of outcome measures, DASH, Euroqol, VAS, EQ5D, American Shoulder and Elbow Surgeon scores, there was no difference between the PROMs for whether they had surgery or they did not have surgery. However, operatively managed patients had more complications and more subsequent surgeries. And there was actually, all the patients did pretty well is the bottom line, except for a minority. So don't operate on mid-shaft clavicle fractures in children and adolescents.
I won't, thank you very much. And I'm going to use these figures and quote them, because it's, I don't know what you find, but it is really difficult, isn't it? Because in those first 7 to 10 days, the patient is so sore, they're displaced, you can see it, you know, even if the skin isn't tented or tethered, it, you know, I find there's quite a lot of parental pressure to do something to fix it. Yeah. And to date, I haven't generally. In fact, have I ever? No, I don't think I've ever fixed a mid-shaft adolescent fracture, but I know of a couple of people who've sought private opinions elsewhere for it. But I really like this paper and I think it's really sensible.
Yeah, I think we've talked about a couple of other papers that this group has done. They've been publishing as they go along, but there was a complete hole in terms of this type of study, really. There's a lot of long-term series for adolescents and the evidence had been largely in favor of non-operative, but there are a few papers out there saying it should be operative fixation. So actually this paper, I think, answers that question really nicely. I have, and I don't fix them myself, I referred one to one of my shoulder colleagues because the adolescent was a horse rider. And we all felt it was probably a way of getting them back to their, as in they're a professional horse rider, as a way of getting them back to their sport quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, what I liked about this was we always worry about, will they have the full remodeling potential? You know, people say, oh, the clavicle doesn't come out to length and that's going to cause problem with shoulder strength in years to come. And yes, this is a relatively short follow-up, isn't it? But I imagine these guys are just going to keep, hopefully, following this group up. So we've got some medium-term and longer-term results. Yeah. But at this stage to see no significant difference is a really big thing, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, good paper. Good acronym as well, FACTS. We're getting the facts.
Yeah, like that.
Yeah.
There we go. So my final paper is from, I hope I pronounce it correctly, Gurges et al. So it's collaboration between Vancouver and Edinburgh, JPO, August 2022. So efficacy and safety of sleeper plates in temporary hemiepiphysiodesis and the observation of tethering. Now, look, this is no means the best paper, and I'm not even sure you can classify this as research, but I thought it addressed an interesting concept. So at EPOS in Copenhagen, I met Pete Stevens, and he was telling me that he always leaves a sleeper plate in. So I thought, okay, well, maybe I should, because we avoid doing it because of concerns about tethering.
Yeah.
So in this paper, they talk about their experience. It's a classic one where they say, we started with loads of patients, but we're going to tell you about a very small proportion of them.
Yeah.
But anyway, they reported on 25 sleeper plates in 17 patients, a very heterogeneous group, but basically 13 knees maintained a stable correction after screw removal. 9 patients had some rebound, but 4 showed some tethering. So they put 16% tethering, then with overcorrection. So it does happen. The bottom line is that tethering occurs. And if you observe it, which you should probably look quite carefully for, you can take the plate out and then there is no ongoing tethering. They felt that one of the reasons behind that might be some bleeding from that metaphyseal screw hole. And then you're getting some bone spur forming, and the bone then captures the metaphyseal component of the plate, causing the tethering. So they recommend putting some bone wax down to minimize bleeding with bone spur formation. On the basis of this paper, I'm not sure whether I'll change my practice with regards to sleeper plates, because I don't think putting in a new plate takes that long. And the screws sometimes break. So you have a plate which is not in the most ideal position, with a screw which might be a bit fatigued. You might be able to put in bigger screws in a bigger patient as well. So I don't know. Do you guys use sleeper plates much?
So I have done it maybe 2 or 3 times, and I've been really disappointed in it. Not for any reason, not for tethering or anything, but you make almost as big a hole to take out one screw as you do to put in a whole new plate. And I've never felt that there's any economy in just taking out one screw. So I've stopped. So if I feel something needs to come out, the whole thing comes out. And like you said, you might get the bigger screw in the next time. You might not want your epiphyseal screw being in that position that it, you know, a year and a half, 2 years later. So I take them all out.
Yeah, I heard about the sleeper plate concept and it sounds really cool. But to me, it just didn't make sense. I was thinking, unless you put in a really long plate when you first put it in, it just sounds like they're going to grow off it, because they'll affect their correction. And then you take a screw out and then they get bigger as the deformity recurs. So I just didn't see the benefit, really. And you're right. Based on the numbers you've given, actually, I just don't see the point. I don't think it does take that big an incision to just put a new one in.
Yeah.
Great. Well, those are my papers, Anish.
Brilliant. Okay. So as everyone knows, we talk about something that's relevant, and this is the Halloween episode this time around. So Claire, what would you say is your favorite Halloween film or scary film?
Scary film. Yes. Mine isn't a Halloween film.
Okay.
Mine is, can I have two? Which is Silence of the Lambs plus Hannibal, the sequel. To me, those are probably the only films I've ever watched that really properly scared me. I think they are absolutely fantastic. I've watched them again and again, read the books. Really good. That, you know, when the man is suspended from the balcony.
Yeah.
And he falls forward and he's been disemboweled and his bowels fall out everywhere. That's a particular favourite. That was a real scream moment.
And there are just some moments. I mean, in Silence of the Lambs, a bit at the end when she's in the dark and he's walking around with those glasses, as you know, he's got those kind of night specs, hasn't he? And he can see her. That film was awesome. And I think...
And you can hear the breathing.
Yeah. And the whole concept that he's kind of kidnapping women just to skin them to make himself an outfit. It's just... it is really grim and gruesome. And I think I might have been like 14 or maybe younger when I saw that, which probably wasn't the appropriate age. I think it was rated a little bit higher, but
I'm pretty sure I was about 28, but maybe I wasn't. maybe not.
And then how about you, Alpesh?
Well, I put it on the Twitter. So the Japanese Ring is really scary. And actually The Grudge as well, the Japanese one, is just, yeah, they, and even talking about it makes my eyes water a bit.
Oh, I need to watch them then.
Well, this is it. So the whole point of this podcast is it's supposed to educate. So yes. There you go. For those of you who aren't into J horror, we've got two suggestions. And actually my my last registrar has just moved on from us. He recommended Don't Look Up. There are two versions. I have to look this up, but there is a Japanese horror film called Don't Look Up. And I suspect he means that one rather than the more recent Netflix film with, I think it was Brad Pitt.
That's the one I was thinking of.
it wasn't that scary. It was about the environment, really, wasn't it? And then how about you, Pranay?
I'm not much of a scary movie person. But one from childhood would be watching Scream when we were like maybe 10 years old. That was an experience.
That is great. Yeah, I think I was a little bit older than that. I was officially allowed in the cinema for that one.
Never seen it. Isn't that awful? I've never seen the screen.
It is definitely, the first one is definitely worthwhile. Because it kind of talks about the rules of horror films and almost parodies horror films whilst being scary at the same time. So we did put this out on Twitter. Emily Baird came up with A Quiet Place. I don't know if you guys have seen that. And that is really good, isn't it? I went to see that not knowing what to expect and was blown away by that. And then I think it was probably a book and a film about work-life balance, but The Shining.
Oh, yes.
Lee Van Rensburg from Adam Brooks has mentioned that. And that was all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. And we're talking about the importance of that in current times, aren't we? But it's the thing about Jack Nicholson, isn't it? Even in that film where he's playing this kind of dowdy psycho nutter, he's still so cool.
Anish, I'm not sure if any of those terms are appropriate.
Sorry, Pranav, maybe a bit of an edit on that one. And then I thought what was, well, we've got a couple of others. So Helen Chase came in with Aliens. She put that on Twitter, which definitely a really scary film. And I love the tagline, you know, in space, no one can hear you scream. But she has mentioned that actually it was quite a happy ending because the cat survived. So
brilliant.
And then Darius Rad, our own BizCos publicity comms officer, came up with, have any of you seen Dr. Terror's House of Horror?
No.
I feel like this has got to be homework, okay? Because I've had to Google it. It has Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, Donald Sutherland. Okay, so like absolute classics of the horror genre. It got 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. So
never seen.
Yeah, apparently 5 chilling stories linked by the character of a strange fortune-telling doctor. So we've got to check that out. And then possibly the most appropriate for a BizCos podcast was Neil Kang from Adam Brooks, who feels Child's Play. A good horror film. So, yeah, I think with our society's kind of aim and ambitions, that would probably be the one that is most relevant. What would I say? I would say, have you guys seen The Babadook?
Yeah.
That one actually freaked me out. I got home. You've got to check it out. It is a really low budget Australian film. It's been on TV a few times. Please do check that out.
I apologize. I've never even heard of it, but I'll write that down.
It's on iPlayer.
Watch it after I've read all the papers.
Papers first, film secondary.
Yeah.
Right. So moving on to my bite size. So I looked at 5 papers and as we were talking about, there was a real difficulty trying to whittle them down. So there's been some good papers again about using screw up episiodesis for the proximal femur in CP from Jim McCarthy. There was a good paper about Sufi screws, a really big series of supracondylar fractures that still tell you that median nerve palsy is the most common, but it was a very big series. So there's a load of stuff out there that I had to filter out. So what did I include? Well, the first paper was from Developmental Medicine and Child Neurology. By Church et al. And one of the senior authors there is Freeman Miller. So this is from the Nemours Kids Hospital in Delaware. And what they look at is walking activity after multi-level orthopedic surgery in children with CP. I don't know if you guys, you know, walking activity sounds really obvious. I just thought, oh, it's about how much they walk. But actually, it's a measure that is used by the WHO as part of their outcome measures in kids' general health scores. And it really makes sense, doesn't it? If we're going to be doing surgery on children to help them with their walking, then surely we should check their walking activity, which is quantified by the number of strides they take per day. So this was a really good, it was a retrospective review. But what's interesting is that these children seem to have been using something called the stepwatch, which is a little bit like what you describe for your paper about desks, Alpesh. So it's an accelerometer that they wear at the ankle, and they wore it pre-op and also post-op. Now, these patients were operated between 2011 and 2020. They were largely GMFCS3s with quite a few twos, a few ones, and some GMFCS4s. And then they had certain inclusion criteria. So to be included, they had to have worn that stepwatch for 3 days at least in the pre-op period and the post-op period. And that was 8 hours per day. And that was within 24 months of surgery. They also did a load of secondary outcomes, as you'd expect in a CP paper. So GMFM, the gait deviation index, and some strength measures as well. And what they did was they quantified the multi-level surgery as either low burden, which was only one osteotomy and soft tissue work, or high burden, which was two or more osteotomies. Okay. And what they said was that if you had an improvement or a decline, it was defined as being at least half a standard deviation from the baseline normalized strides per day by GMFCS level. So they've got this reference data. They had 178 children. Some of them had multi-level surgery twice. They had almost 200 events for multi-level surgery. 65% were low burden, 35% high burden. Now, average return to baseline walking activity was 3 months after the low burden multi-level surgery. So that's not too bad. It was 1 year, 2 months after the high burden surgery, which is what I think a lot of people, you know, I was thinking in my head, I always say 6 months to a year. But actually, this is showing a year. 36% improved in their walking activity, 46% declined. And I think that that is a big figure. I think so, telling families that actually there's about a 50% chance that their child's walking activity will be worse after our surgery rather than better. So I thought this was a really important and interesting paper. And, you know, it's a big unit for cerebral palsy. So no one's going to say, oh, it's because they don't know what they're doing. What they said was, if you're a younger child and lower burden surgery, you're more likely to have good outcomes. And as do those who are less impaired in terms of their walking beforehand. So the children who are better at walking will do better, which is, I guess, common sense. And one thing they talk about is the concept of prehabilitation. So working really hard with the physio to build everything up before you do surgery. So I thought there were some really good things to take from this paper. One was using the stepwatch, which, you know, you kind of think it's like a Fitbit, but just stuck to your ankle. Really simple way of measuring outcomes. Prehabilitation, I think a lot of us talk about that, but maybe we need to really formalize that. And three, yeah, in terms of counseling families. I mean, I don't know what you guys think. Would you have thought that half would decline?
No, I think it was a really honest paper.
Yeah.
As well, really honest. And no, I wouldn't have thought that. I think some of the terms that they've used are lovely, like, you know, you need a rehabilitation commitment from the family.
Yeah.
I think we don't emphasize that enough to families. I think no matter how much you tell them, I think a lot of the families still get such a surprise at what's involved. And I've never seen the term burden used before in this sense. And I, you know, that it's a tough word, burden, isn't it? But to say that your child is going through high burden surgery is, maybe we need to be a little more honest and a little more blunt in our descriptions with families, because, you know, these are children who have rehabbed over a long period of time and they've still not really reached what many of us would hope for them.
I think this highlights the issues with decision making with GMFCS3 patients, really, doesn't it? I mean, we have our gait lab interpretation every week, and we've got patients who are like, okay, we can see all these abnormalities, we can theoretically correct them, but are we doing the child a favor? Long run? And sometimes we just say, well, look, we don't know. If they're on board, we'll give it a shot. If they're not, we won't.
Yeah. And I think that's the bits here, isn't it? So stressing the burden, as you say, Claire, and what you're saying, Alpesh, about being on board. And I think the prehab is probably a good way. I do that with some of my patients, not necessarily CP, to see whether they are going to fare well, because I actually say to them, you're going to need to rehab afterwards. I want to see how you do it beforehand. And I think making sure they realize exactly how long a journey this is going to be. And so now I'm going to change it from 6 months to a year to it's going to be at least a year.
Yeah.
So that was my CP paper for, because again, there were some really good CP papers in DMC. My second paper is trauma. And I don't know if you guys have noticed, but there's been a trend for, you know, so when you're doing Viva practice for the FRCS, okay, I hear a lot of the lateral condyle, it's a fracture of necessity. And you're kind of what does that actually mean? And someone finally explained to me, it means you've got to fix it. And I think some people do that, don't they? So there's a lateral condyle, you need to see the joint surface, I will fix it. I think the Song classification, the Jacob and Fowles classification, I like those because there's a concept of the intact articular hinge. And now there have been some papers, and I think there was one from Toronto previously as well, one from Korea, and now we've got one from China that's been published in International Orthopedics. So that's Liu et al. Comparing closed reduction with open reduction. Now, it's a 4-year study period. They had a minimum of 12 months follow-up, but mean was 18 months. It wasn't randomized, so it was surgeon preference. They had a few surgeons, though. So I think it was 3 in one group who liked closed reduction and percutaneous pinning. And these are for displaced. So this is fully displaced lateral condyle fractures.
And some of them were really displaced.
I mean, yeah, the picture they showed, you're like,
it was in another room.
Closer to the other arm. And they talk through the procedure, which I thought was quite interesting. And again, it's one of those things where, so they put K-wire into the articular cavity, then that's to evacuate the articular cavity, then thumb pressure or K-wire to push the fragment back to turn it into a type 2. Then you put in a 1.6, then you put in 3 2-millimeter wires. So it sounds like a lot of effort. And having fixed one on Thursday, where I just opened it up and you see how displaced it was, I was sitting there thinking, would I have been able to do this closed? But I just wonder whether I need to give it a go now. So they did this, 42 children got the closed reduction and they were successful in 39 out of those 42. 36 had an open reduction internal fixation. Operative times just over an hour for the closed reduction versus almost an hour and a half for the open reduction. But as you can imagine, they used a lot of fluoroscopy in that closed reduction group. No significant differences in terms of their outcomes, except there was only one AVN. And interestingly, that was in the closed reduction group, not in the open reduction group. So I don't know what you guys think. Would you, so Claire, would you now give it a go? Would you sit there thinking, let me just take this back in?
I'm not convinced I would. And I'll tell you why. I find these really tricky. And I find them tricky when I'm opening them and when I'm actually looking at where it has to go. Sometimes getting the rotation is still tricky. And the thing I find most difficult is the flexion and extension of that fragment. And I'm not sure on this paper that that's being fully addressed. Now, maybe it doesn't matter hugely. You know, maybe we don't need to be concerned about it. But in particular, the picture that they showed with the rotation, I just don't know how you would get it back. And also, when you do open it, there's just always that really annoying flap of periosteum from the posterior surface of the humerus that's in the way. You know, so good. All I could think was, fantastic, they must be much better surgeons than me if they can get these back closed. But I would really struggle. I might, in my next one, I might use a thumb and see what I can get before I open it.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't think I would ever take somebody to theatre with one of these and think, oh God, I'll just do this closed.
Yeah.
You know, I think I would always aim to do it open, but let's see what we can get. And the other thing is the sticking the wire in the joint to decompress it. I thought that was odd. I think they probably meant a syringe and needle, did they not?
No, I think what it is it's through the joint and into the fracture gap. But again, when you think about how you'd really do that, it doesn't, you know, they've got a nice picture there, haven't they, where they kind of shove it in.
I just don't know how that decompresses the joint with the hemarthrosis.
I think my take on it was, well, I suppose what I'm thinking is there's a few papers coming out now that show that this is going on. And maybe what we need, I might do what you describe and basically have a bit of a play before I open it up if I feel like it's necessary.
Yeah.
Right. Then we've got, so I try to get journals that we won't necessarily look at as pediatric orthopedic surgeons. So there's a paper from Foot and Ankle Surgery Journal from Amsterdam. And it was a systematic review looking at coalitions. And I thought this was really interesting because it was 1,200 coalitions in 1,000 patients. Mean age was 17 years, between 11 and 41. The reason why I thought it was really interesting was the success rates I've always thought were much better for calcaneo-navicular coalitions versus talocalcaneal. And I have to be honest, I don't enjoy talocalcaneal coalitions. They've said they're basically 80% for both. They said that conservative talocalcaneals are more likely to fail. I can believe that. Open 80%, arthroscopic 86%. Do any of you do your coalitions arthroscopically? No.
Yeah. I must put that on my list of things to learn.
The arthroscopic numbers in this systematic review were much lower though. And again, what was interesting was interposition in calcaneo-navicular coalitions. I always wonder, is it necessary? Is it worthwhile? They said the success rate was 81% with and 69% without, according to their data. And recurrence and revision, talocalcaneal coalition, 2% recurrence, 7% revision, compared to 16% recurrence for calcaneo-navicular and 9% revision. So much higher for the calcaneo-navicular coalitions. Now, I guess the devil is going to be in the detail with all of this. And this is just broad brushstroke some data. And it may be simple things like actually no one really wants to go in to try and revise a talocalcaneal coalition. And so you'll pretend there isn't a recurrence. That's my explanation of this, where you'll be happier to have a crack at a calcaneo-navicular coalition.
And the CT machine's broken.
Yeah. But that's
there's recurrence, or there's the bit that you left as well, isn't there? So
yeah, exactly.
I'm with you on that.
And I don't think it's that easy.
Allegedly that can happen. So
yes, I've heard. Yeah,
I've heard. Not to me. But I thought that was a really interesting paper because it kind of goes against everything that I've always been taught and everything that I teach. So that was some interesting evidence there. Couple more papers, one very quick one, which was about trends in weight loss amongst children in England. And this is from Archives Diseases of Childhood, which is a BMJ journal. And basically what they looked at, so there is the health survey in England that happens for children pretty much annually. And what they did was look at various time points. So the first was 97, 98. And then although it's done every year, they don't always ask the weight loss question, but they asked it for quite a few years. And the last one was in 2015-16. And what they found was there was a significant increase in children who were reporting attempts at weight loss, which, given what we always hear about weight going up in children, I thought was quite interesting. So 21% in 97 to 98 said that they were trying to lose weight. Compared to 26.4% in 2015. So that's an increase of about 5%. The rates were higher according to your BMI. And if you break it down by age, it's about a third of 13 to 17 year olds report trying to lose weight, which again, I thought was just, it doesn't say about whether they're successful and what was achieved. But the other thing that was interesting in this was that the significant increases in rates of reported weight loss were more so in boys than in girls over this time period. So whereas the absolute numbers are higher in girls, the increases have been higher in boys. And I was interested in this because I just thought, well, it'd be interesting to see where it goes. And obviously, the eating disorder aspect has become massive. And it's really difficult. I don't know what you guys think when you're in clinic and you're trying to counsel people about weight loss. It can be really sensitive. And you certainly don't want to give anyone a big complex about it. And it's difficult, I think it's important to try and approach it in an appropriate manner. And again, this data, I think, would be useful in terms of doing that and explaining to a teenager that actually apparently a third of teenagers out there are trying to lose weight. So it's quite common. And if you need to do it, you need to do it. So, yeah.
But I found sometimes it's inappropriate. You know, exactly. Sometimes it's inappropriate. And it's really tricky, isn't it? I mean, that is part of our job, isn't it? To look after the health of the child in front of us and counsel them. But as you say, it is very difficult. I recently had a situation where a trainee spoke really well to a family, you know, very sensitively about the size of their son, in order to help. And he got a complaint, a significant complaint because of it. So it's very, very difficult. And equally, I think we've all had children sitting in front of us where we think, goodness, they're losing too much weight.
Yeah. And I think it's something that we mustn't be frightened to broach, but we just need to know how, really. Then two final very quick papers. I think I'd already said that I've got just one more, but I'm cheating. I've got two more. There's one I have to mention. So one paper, JPO, looking at clubfoot. So this was from Sick Kids, Adar and Bouchard. And this was a retrospective study over 17 years. And what was interesting is they looked at idiopathic clubfoot and whether there was a limb length discrepancy of over half a centimetre or not. 300 children, mean follow-up 5 years. And what they found was that overall, out of this whole group, 9% had a limb length discrepancy and the mean magnitude was 1.2 centimetres. So not big. But out of those children who had a limb length discrepancy, 15% were unilateral clubfoot, and the relapse rate had a relative risk of 2.89 in those with a limb length discrepancy. And that group had higher rates of open TA lengthening and also tibant tendon transfer with a relative risk of about 5. And it's something that I think a lot of people don't routinely measure is the limb length discrepancy, particularly at kind of presentations, they're all very little. But I thought this was really interesting. It's just an observational study. It's not proper science. But actually, something, you know, if I'm honest, I thought the rate of limb length discrepancy was higher in clubfoot than their results show, but they've got a decent series. And actually, the correlation with having problems. So there were high, the Pirani score was the same in both groups at presentation, but the number of casts was higher in the limb length discrepancy group. And so was this rate of surgery. So I thought it was a good thing to keep an eye on when you're looking at these patients and then counselling them into the future.
But there, so one thing they said before, the children were ambulant, or or they could, you could get limb length x-rays. They were just using tape measures. And but then tape measure, you're not necessarily including the foot, are you? Where the problem is, if you...
Well, so you're right. And this is what I wasn't sure whether they included, because actually, you know, for a lot of people, we use the heel pad when we're measuring. So, where Claire did her fellowship, Mr. Hill made a big point of that ASIS down to the heel pad.
Yeah.
And so that would take into account, but they didn't say in this paper what they did. At standing and walking age, they did blocks, but they never took x-rays, apparently. None of this was using limb lengths. So that's the problem with the 1.2, isn't it? You could, there must be some inter and intra-observer error there. And finally, I feel like we have to mention Star Wars or the Force. Okay, so you've got Dan Perry publication in The Lancet, almost 1,000 children aged 4 to 15 with a torus fracture from 23 hospitals in the UK. Rigid splintage, which was primarily a futura splint in most of those cases, some had a back slab, versus the offer of bandage group. Pain was equivalent at 3 days.
And are you speaking to hermits, mate? Because I think everyone knows the results of this paper.
Well, but you know, I don't think they do. And actually, what's a little bit worrying is there are a lot of hospitals that still don't use futura splints for buccal fractures. And that was evident at BOA, actually, in a session that I was sitting in. Okay. The one bit that I thought was interesting, actually, was a 7 days median use of bandage in the bandage group, 18 days in the rigid splint group. So once you give them a splint, they're not going to want to get rid of that. And I thought there'd be no difference. And the other bit that I didn't really pay attention to before was 11% from the bandage group did come back and go to a splint primarily because of pain.
Yeah.
Which isn't high. I don't think it's, you know, it wouldn't change, you know, it wouldn't put me off the idea, but it is a kind of something we've got to be aware of. The only thing I'd say about this paper is we still struggle at my hospital with people saying that's a buccal fracture and giving them a futurous splint and discharging them, they often still get called distal radius fracture and put into a back slab, and then we have to do that via our virtual clinic.
Hopefully. Absolutely, yeah.
So what I think now is we're going to say you can use a tubi grip, and then they'll think, oh, we better go a little bit better than that. We'll put them in a futurous splint. So that's how I hope it's going to change our practice. But yeah, did you guys, I think FORCE is a really nicely done study, isn't it? You just think it's the first decent randomized controlled trial in orthopedics from this country in terms of pediatrics, but there's many more to come, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's really, it's super. And yeah, I feel that we've made such a massive leap changing from a back slab to a futural splint. To take one more big leap to tubi grip would be great, and it shows that we should be able to, but it's tricky, and particularly when the parents are still asking if it's a break or a fracture. Do you guys get that? Is that a Glaswegian thing? I'm not going to do the Glaswegian accent because I think it counts, but they very much say, oh, but you're saying it was a fracture, but the real doctor I saw in the emergency department said it was a break.
We call it a buccal injury. So,
that doesn't happen.
Yeah, so then it's not, it's not broken bone.
Buccal injury, how clever. Well, I'm going to write that down.
There you go. We've learned about films, we've learned about little things like that too. Right, so we should probably wrap up. I've had the time warning from producer. So, Claire, thank you very much for joining us. I was just looking. So apparently the peak temperature in Glasgow in the summer is about 20 degrees. And I think in Oxfordshire, it's been 18 degrees today in autumn. So
it is actually. I've been in my swimsuit most of the day. My shades on. No, I wouldn't wish that upon Oxfordshire. But I've had my sunglasses on. And I did bring wellies for going out walking, and I'm not sure I'm going to need them.
Hopefully you won't. So, yeah, thank you very much for joining us. Any last comments before we wrap up, guys?
No, really good fun. No. Thank you for that, and very informative.
Cheers. Thank you. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween, everyone.